Fresh Air is James Farmer, one of the architects of the civil rights movement in America. In 1943, Farmer co-founded CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. CORE's statement of purpose was to eliminate all racial segregation and discrimination through nonviolent direct action. CORE is one of the first groups to apply Gandhi's principles of nonviolent resistance in the civil rights movement. CORE became nationally known in 1961 when it organized the first Freedom Rides. Small interracial groups of people rode buses through the South to test the Supreme Court decision banning segregation in bus terminals serving interstate passengers. As CORE became more successful, its emphasis shifted from desegregation to political action and fighting economic discrimination and problems in black communities. Farmer was the national director of CORE from 1961 to 66. Before that, he was program director for the NAACP. In 1966, he accepted the position of assistant secretary of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare in the Nixon administration. He left 1 year later in frustration. Since then, he's lectured and consulted on minority affairs and served as the executive director of the Coalition of American Public Employees. James Farmer has just written a memoir. It's called Lay Bare the Heart, and it's published by Arbor House. If you'd like to meet James Farmer, he will be reading from his new memoir and signing books the 7 o'clock this evening at Robin's Bookstore at 108 South 13th Street. If you'd like more information about that, you can call Robin's Books at 735-9600. James Farmer, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Great pleasure to meet you again.
That's a pleasure to be here.
Establish again what the philosophy was of CORE before we talk about some of the work you did with that and afterwards. Mm.
Well, first of all, at that time I was a pacifist, a conscientious objector in World War II. And as a pacifist, I was concerned with finding nonviolent solutions to violent conflict situations domestically as well as internationally. It wasn't enough just to refuse to participate in war. We had to find nonviolent means for dealing with some of the social conflict situations like race relations, including segregation and racial discrimination, and like labor management problems in industry. But my primary interest was, of course, race. And therefore, I was driven to study Gandhi, who was the main architect of the technique which he calls Satyagraha, meaning soul force. We have come to call it nonviolent direct action or nonviolent resistance. It became popularized in this country in 1956 with the Montgomery bus boycott led by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. But in 1942, along with some other pacifists, white and black, we studied Gandhi and decided to experiment with the technique, trying to adapt it and apply it to the American scene, recognizing that America is not India, and it was not India then. In India, the Indians were a huge majority, and the British were a tiny minority. In this country, the blacks who were oppressed were a small minority, and the whites were a large majority. Furthermore, nonviolence was an integral part of the Hindu culture. In this country, the culture tended to be the big fist wins. It tended to be violent and strength. Therefore, we were fighting a difficult battle to establish this principle. However, we started, after studying Gandhi, sitting in restaurants, beginning in the city of Chicago. And we had considerable success. We integrated a number of restaurants. People may be astonished to learn that in those years, in the early 1940s, and this was 1942, there was widespread segregation in public places in northern cities. We had wade-ins in swimming pools and public beaches, which had excluded blacks, stand-ins in cafeteria lines and theater lines and so on. And it spread to a number of other cities. We spread it, that is. Then we organized the national organization of CORE, which became the Congress of Racial Equality.
Well, you're talking about desegregating northern segregated restaurants. And one of the actions you took in 1942 was, I think, at the Jack Spratt restaurant. You said that you called the police before the action so that they knew what would be happening. Why'd you do that?
Well, we did that because we were ideological Gandhians at that time. And Gandhi had said it is important to be open and above board, to let the authorities know precisely what you were going to do, when you were going to do it, and how you were going to do it, so that nobody would be guessing about what you were doing. And they would have no misconceptions about it at all. And for that reason, before we had our sit-in at this small restaurant in the South Side Chicago, now it's the Hyde Park Kenwood District of Chicago, in the area of the University of Chicago, I called the police precinct and spoke to one of the officers there and told him what we were going to do, how we were going to do it, and when we were going to do it. I even read a copy of the state's ancient civil rights law to him, one of those laws which had been passed during Reconstruction days and had seldom been used since. He assured me that if we followed the peaceful pattern that I had outlined, there would be no grounds on which he could throw us out. We would not be disturbing the peace. We would not be trespassing if the place were open for business. So that's what we did. Now, while we were sitting in at the Jack Sprat, the manager called the police, expecting the police to throw us out. The police came but declined to throw us out and said, what are these people doing? They're not disturbing the peace and they're not trespassing. What do you want us to do? She said, throw them out. And they refused. She said, well, can't you throw them out on the grounds that we reserve the right to seat our patrons and would serve some of them, meaning the blacks, in the basement? Well, this policeman didn't know, and he went to the phone booth and I suppose called headquarters for instructions. He came out smiling and said, no, lady, there is nothing in the state law that allows us to do that. You must either serve them or solve the problem yourself.
Were the restaurant owners pretty baffled? Because this was before desegregation through this technique became a common thing, you know, by the...
Yes.
There's a period when it was being tried in many places in the South, and although it upset the restaurant owners and the people running the lunch counter, they knew what it was. They'd heard about it before. It wasn't the case here. No one knew about it.
They were baffled. They knew nothing about the nonviolent technique or the sit-in technique. They considered us, I guess, a bunch of crazies. Didn't know what we were about and what we were doing. They were very, very angry. However, in this area of Chicago, near the University of Chicago, and most of the customers, regular patrons, were middle-class Chicagoans from the university area. Some were faculty members of the university and others students. They tended to sympathize with us. And they were curious about what was going on, the drama that was being played out before their eyes, and asked some of our sit-in people, what's going on? They explained to them, and they talked it over among themselves, and then came back to our sit-inners and said to them, well, we agree with you, and we've decided that we're not going to leave until you're all served. So everybody in the restaurant was sitting in, either out of sympathy or out of curiosity. So the place was completely tied up. There was no turnover of business. And we won.
Now, the kind of reaction you got from the authorities in Chicago is very different than the kind you later got when you were working in the South. Why did CORE decide to change its focus from the North to the South?
Well, the South was the major problem, the most overt practice of segregation and discrimination. I must say that we hesitated for some years before really committing ourselves to going into the Deep South. At each CORE convention from 1943 until the mid-50s, we debated whether to, as we called it, invade the South with the technique of nonviolent resistance. Each year it was voted down because we considered that it would be suicidal. Not so much for ourselves, we cared about our own lives, of course, but suicidal for the local blacks who would have to live there after we had left. We felt that there would be violent reprisals against them, and we didn't think that the training was sufficient for them to withstand it. However, nonviolence sprang to life in the mid-50s in Montgomery. And at that time, the cat was out of the bag, so to speak, and nonviolence was on its way. And we then moved into the South. Corps moved in quickly when the Southern student sit-ins began in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1960, and helped to spread that movement throughout the South. And then in 1961, as you observed a few minutes ago, Corps started the Freedom Rides, and we carried them out, and SNCC joined us in the Freedom Rides after we reached Alabama. There was much, much violence, and Kennedy asked us to halt the Freedom Rides. In fact, by the time the Freedom Rides reached Montgomery, one of the buses had been burned to the ground at Anniston, Alabama. Freedom Riders had been brutally beaten. Jim Peck, a white Freedom Rider from New York, was left for dead, lying in a pool of his own blood, and he had 56 stitches taken in his head. Dr. Walter Bergman, also white, who was 61 or 62, a professor from Michigan, who was a Freedom Rider, was so brutally beaten about the head that he suffered a stroke and was paralyzed and has been confined to a wheelchair ever since, and he's now in his 80s. So all of this had happened. When we reached Montgomery, there was a riot, not the riots that people became accustomed to in the North in the summers from 64 to 68, but a white riot with white men marauding the streets, beating up blacks whom they saw on the streets. And these rioters held the Freedom Riders prisoner in a black church, a First Baptist church. Dr. King flew in from Atlanta to speak in that church. Ralph Abernathy similarly spoke in the church at this rally, and I was there at the church. Bobby Kennedy called down to the church, spoke to King, and asked Dr. King to talk with me and try to get me to halt the Freedom Ride and have a cooling-off period. After discussing it with the other Freedom Riders, my answer was, we've been cooling off for 350 years. If we cool off any more, we'll be in a deep freeze, so the Freedom Ride will continue. Well, Bobby Kennedy thought that that was arrogant, and he was quite angry.
When you're a busload of Freedom Riders, you're really a moving target. Did you wonder whether civil disobedience, passive resistance was going to work or just leave a lot of victims in its wake?
Well, we wondered that, of course. I must say, we didn't consider this civil disobedience because though we were violating laws of those southern states and local ordinances in the areas through which we were riding, we were not violating federal law. We were acting in accord with federal law as had been determined by the United States Supreme Court, which had ruled on two occasions that racial segregation in interstate travel was unconstitutional. So we felt we were abiding by the law rather than violating it. But there were times when we wondered whether things were going to be changed or whether we were just going to be brutalized. The philosophy, the rationale for the whole thing, my rationale was that we had somehow to create a crisis situation so that the federal government would be compelled to enforce federal law over and against the conflicting state laws of segregation. And that's what we tried to do, and it succeeded.
There was a ride from Montgomery to Alabama that you were going to be on. You had been on the Freedom Ride before that, but you were called away because your father died, and you went to attend his funeral. Mm. I think it was your mother who suggested that your father, who had been sick for a while, had timed his death to coincide with the Alabama ride.
Yes. Before we left, before the Freedom Riders left Washington, this was on May 4th of 1961, I went to visit my father, who was a terminal patient of cancer in Washington, D.C. hospital, told him what we were going to do, how we were going to do it, and where we were going through Virginia, the Carolinas, Georgia, Alabama, through Mississippi, and hopefully arriving in New Orleans. He, being a Southerner himself and a scholar, thought for a while, and says, "Well, I think you'll be all right in Virginia and the Carolinas, maybe even Georgia, but not in Alabama. They'll take a pot shot at you there. I don't think you'll reach Mississippi. If you should reach Mississippi, then you will think that Alabama was purgatory and Mississippi is hell. But you certainly won't reach New Orleans." He said, "I wish you wouldn't go, but I know you will." Now, after I left, I had left my father a copy of the itinerary, of course. My mother says that each day he would pick up my itinerary and look at it and to see where I was. "Oh, he's in North Carolina. That's all right." But when he picked up the piece of paper with my schedule on it and saw, he's just about to go through Alabama, then he just let go and died. She believed that he had been holding on to the tenuous thread of life until this time so that his death could bring me back before going through Alabama. She believed that until her death 5 years later. I don't know whether that's possible or not, but it apparently worked.
Alabama was one of the most violent stops.
Yes.
It was the stop you referred to before, where one man was found in the pool of his own blood, and,
yes,
and the doctor was beaten around the head and suffered a stroke afterwards. Do you ever look back on that and wonder if you would have survived had you been on the bus when it went through Alabama?
Yes, of course. I'm quite confident that I would have been killed, that I would have died. You see, I had scheduled myself to lead the testing in the waiting rooms in the bus terminals in Alabama, because this was going to be the critical one. I was going to lead the testing. I was going to enter first the white waiting room at all of the stops in Alabama. I was going to make the decisions that had to be made on the spot there. But when I was called back to Washington to bury my father just hours before the bus left Atlanta to go through Alabama, I left a Jim Peck, this then-young white freedom rider, in charge of the testing. He was almost killed in Birmingham, and I feel quite certain that I would have been killed had I been there. My father thought that I would not have survived Alabama, and Mother thinks that's the reason he died when he did. But then Montgomery...
Well, you almost didn't go to Montgomery.
Well, I almost did not go to Jackson, Mississippi.
I'm sorry, yeah, that's right. That's
from
right.
Montgomery. I didn't want to go because after what had happened in Alabama, I thought going into Mississippi would be worse. You know, Mississippi at that time had the reputation of being the ultra, the apex of racism. it was considered even worse than Alabama. And I thought that what had happened in Alabama then would be only a prelude to what awaited us in Mississippi. Yet the young Freedom Riders, the first group of 13, couldn't go on. They had been so brutalized. They were hospitalized, all bandaged up, others suffering smoke inhalation from that burned-out bus. So that a new group of Freedom Riders, SNCC young people, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, from Nashville, young core people from New Orleans had joined forces in Montgomery to take the ride into Jackson. And I was there, and they presumed I was going with them since it was my show. Nobody asked me if I was going. They just assumed it. But I had other thoughts because, well, my father had just died, and two deaths in the family in a week would be a bit much for my mother and for the family. Furthermore, I'd been away from my office for 6 weeks, and mail had piled high, and people needed answers to their letters, and Corps had to raise money to keep its activities going, including the Freedom Ride, and I was needed to help in that process. Furthermore, somebody, the titular head of Corps, the national director, me, had to be there to... negotiate, to talk with the White House, with the Department of Justice, with the FBI. Oh, I'd cataloged all of these excuses in my mind, but the bottom line was that I was scared to death. And that's the reason I didn't want to go. And I was determined not to go because I wanted to live. I did not want to die then. I went down that morning that the young Freedom Riders were going to board their buses for the journey from Montgomery, Alabama, to Jackson, Mississippi. I went down really to say goodbye to them and wish them Godspeed. I remember reaching through the open window of a bus to shake hands with a 17-year-old core girl from New Orleans, Doris Castle. I said, "Well, Doris, have a safe journey, and after the Freedom Rides, we'll get together and we'll discuss the next step." She looked at me in disbelief. She said, "But, Jim, you're going with us, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, no, Doris, you see." And then I went through the whole litany of excuses which I had prearranged in my mind. I couldn't go. I said, "Not all of us are so lucky as to be in the front lines and the trenches. Some of us have to do the dull work back home, you know, keep the home fires burning and mind the store. But I'll be with you in spirit, Doris." And she shook her head and said, "Jim, please." Well, that was too much. I had to go then. And I said to somebody, "Get my luggage and put it on the bus." Now, interestingly enough, I was ambivalent about not going. So I had packed my bag and had it in the trunk of a car there at the bus terminal, just in case I changed my mind and decided to go. And it turned out to be very convenient. But when she said, "Jim, please," I said to a corps aide there, "Get my luggage. Put it on the bus. I'm going."
My guest is James Farmer, civil rights activist and a co-founder and former head of CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality. He's written a new memoir titled Lay Bare the Heart. Well, you encountered quite a lot of trouble on that ride. You were all arrested. What grounds were you arrested on?
There were three charges: disobeying an officer, disturbing the peace, and inciting to riot. We were arrested by Captain Ray, who was the chief of police of the city of Jackson, when he ordered me to move on. And I asked where. The young lady with me, who had locked arms with me, she and I were about to go into the restaurant there in the waiting room, the white waiting room, for dinner. And Captain Ray blocked us and said, "What's your name?" I told him. He said, "Where do you think you're going?" I said, "My friend and I are going in here for dinner." He said, "Move on." "Where?" I asked. "Out." I refused on grounds of the Supreme Court decision. And he said again, "Move on." I refused again. He said, "Did you understand the order?" And I told him I understood it perfectly. He said, "Well, I'll tell you one more time. Move on." I refused, same grounds, and then he arrested me. And other Freedom Riders followed the two of us and were similarly told to get into the paddy wagon. And we were taken to jail. Then I sent orders by my lawyer to my core staff in New York to begin immediately recruiting Freedom Riders, white and black, from all over the country, sending them into Jackson to try, in true Gandhian fashion, to fill up the jails. We were not going to bail out. We were going to stay in as long as we could stay in and still file an appeal, and that turned out to be 40 days and 40 nights.
Did the jails want you out? Did the Mississippi jails want you to post bail so that they could get rid of you? Especially when they knew you wanted to stay.
They
probably wanted whatever you didn't.
Yes. They quickly found out that we were not going to bail out right away. And then what they wanted to do was to make it so uncomfortable for us that we'd wish we had never come and we'd stop others from coming. They did not physically beat us, though they tried once at one place. And that backfired because I got one young man bailed out, and he called the FBI, and he also held a press conference. So that stopped the physical brutality. But they did such things as putting so much salt in the food that we couldn't eat it. Many of us were chain smokers, and we were denied any cigarettes, but the guards would walk by our cells, puffing on cigarettes and blowing the smoke into our cells at great length. We were students or readers. They denied us any newspapers or any books, refused to let any come in, refused to let us have any paper or any pencils to do any writing whatsoever. We were denied any visitors except our lawyer. This was psychological brutality.
You were also banned from singing at one point.
Well, they tried to stop us from singing. We sang all the freedom songs we knew, and we made up new ones. I made up one song, wrote one song. Actually, it was, I put new words to an old labor song, "Which Side Are You On?"
What were the words you wrote?
Well, these words, I can't sing, so I won't even try to sing it. Said, "Come all you freedom fighters, good news to you I'll tell of how the good old freedom ride has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? 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 They say in Hinds County, where Jackson was, Jackson, Mississippi, no neutrals have they met. You're either for the freedom ride or you're Tom for Ross Barnett." He was the governor of Mississippi. "My father was a freedom fighter, and I'm a freedom fighter's son. And I'll stick to the freedom ride till every battle's won." Well, the jailers went wild at our singing because we were singing as loudly as we could, and our voices were wafting out over the city of Jackson. And the windows were open. They would come in and slam our windows shut, and we would open them again and sing more and more and more. Other freedom riders, the black women in another wing, the white men in another wing, the white women in another wing would pick up the song, and so the jailhouse was rocking with freedom song. The jailers are running around saying, "Stop that singing! Stop that singing! Stop it!" And we continued singing because it was good for our morale. It was good for our morale, and if there were any fear left in us, that fear was dissipated by the song.
What did they do to try to prevent you from singing after closing the window and yelling at you didn't work?
Well, in Parchman, the state penitentiary, said, "If you don't stop that singing, we'll take away your mattresses." Well, now that sounds like a juvenile threat, but it was an important threat because the little thin straw mattress was the only comfort we had. Everything else was cold, hard stone and steel in those tiny little cells. But there was this little mattress, which was comfort, which was a symbol of home, symbol of domesticity. And now they're going to take that away. We'd have nothing else. Well, that caused some people to stop singing for a while, until one young man who was a Bible student reminded everybody what they were doing. Said, "Here they're trying to take your soul away, you see. It's not the mattress, it's your soul." And then one freedom rider yelled, "Guards! Guards! Guards!" And the deputy came running out into the cell block to see what was wrong. And this freedom rider shouted, "Come get my mattress! I'll keep my soul!" And then song exploded again. We began singing. Then another time, I have to laugh when I think of this. one freedom rider was complaining that this deputy, who was in charge of the guards, always called us "boy, you boys." He said, "Why does he always call us boy? We are men. I think we ought to refuse to answer until he calls us men." Another one reminded him that that was just a custom down south, and he didn't mean anything derogatory by it. So this fellow said, "I think I'll ask him." He called Deputy Tyson. Said, "Deputy Tyson, what?" Says, "Do you mean anything derogatory when you call us boy?" Deputy Tyson said, "I don't know nothing about no rogatory. All I know is if you boys don't stop that singing, you're going to be singing in the rain." And then somebody started singing again. They pulled in a high-pressure fire hose and washed us all down with it. We tumbled over, and everything was floating in the water in our cells.
one of the Freedom Riders then yelled, "Deputy Tyson, next time you're going to do that, bring us some soap so we can take a shower."
It must have been hard to get over that hosing down, because in addition to the initial impact of those high-pressure hoses, it's not like you had a fresh change of clothes around or a dry mattress to sleep on?
Well, the only thing in the way of clothes we had were a little undershorts, and they had arranged somehow to get tiny little undershorts to the big men and huge undershorts to the little men, so that all of us were walking around holding up our shorts to keep from being completely nude during the cell. So that's all we had. And it didn't matter whether those were wet or not. But we did catch colds as a result of the hosing. And after they had hosed us down, they opened the windows at night and turned on some very strong exhaust fans, which pulled the air. And the air in Mississippi was cool at night, and it swept across us, and we all developed colds.
Did you stop singing after that?
Oh, no, no, no. The singing continued. I had one fear, though, which haunted me. It didn't stop me from singing or anything else. The fear was I suffered from claustrophobia. I was just afraid that they were going to put me in solitary confinement, what they call the hole, which is that little, 3-foot square area, just high enough for you to stand up, bent over, but not to straighten up, and no place to sit down or to lie down, with just a hole in the floor, and leave you in there for days and nights. Now, I was sure that with my claustrophobia, I would go stark raving mad in there and would be screaming to be let out. But fortunately, they did not resort to solitary confinement.
When did you get out of prison?
After the 40 days and 40 nights. I bailed out. Let me repeat that after we got out in 40 days and 40 nights, there were still other Freedom Riders coming in each day, so that the total number of Freedom Riders was increasing daily. But I got out, this had to be in July of 1961, and it was sort of scary getting out. There were a couple of rough-type Mississippi men standing around looking at me. Nobody else was around. I was the only one getting out at that time. I was standing outside of the maximum security unit at Parchman. A van drove up with some white women in it. I found out they were young white Freedom Riders who were just coming in. They recognized me, said, "It's Jim Farmer." Then they began singing, "We Shall Overcome," singing it very loudly. One of these, quote, rednecks, unquote, you know the term, said, "He must be the big cheese." The other one said, "Yeah, if I could get my hands on him, he'd be a dead cheese." And they stood looking at me. Well, once I was in the van that was going to take me to Jackson, back to Jackson and to my lawyer's house, the driver, intentionally, made jackrabbit starts so that I would go tumbling to the back of the van. And when he stopped, he slammed on his brakes. I would then go sliding to the front. I was all banged up by the time I reached Jackson. This was quite intentional.
I'm speaking with James Farmer, civil rights activist, co-founder of CORE, and the author of a new autobiography, which is titled Lay Bare the Heart. In your memoir, you say that civil rights generalship was one quarter leadership, one quarter showmanship, one quarter upsmanship, and one quarter partnership. Did you ever get disillusioned with the upsmanship and the showmanship part and the competition that happened between some of the civil rights leaders and civil rights groups?
Well, not disillusioned, but I came to understand it. At first, I had expected that it would be all serious planning and strategizing for what was best for the movement. But I had to realize that we were dealing with flesh and blood. We were dealing with human beings. All of us were human beings. And we had our frailties, and we had our individual jealousies. And there was competition between them. Now, the organizations were competing for the same headlines and for the same money. Headlines meant money. The organizations got their money chiefly from the same sources, from liberal white contributors. And the contributors had only a certain amount of money to give. They couldn't give to all the organizations. Who would they give to then? They would give to the organization whose name and whose leader's name was in the most recent headline. And that was the reason the organizations competed for public relations, for the media, for headlines, because of that competition for money. And it's the reason, one reason, there was so much jealousy between the organizational heads. Another reason is that everybody who was number two or number three or number four would like to be number one. King was number one because he was the most prestigious, the most prominent, the best known, the best covered by the media, so that there was considerable envy of Martin Luther King.
Do you think he deserved that position?
Deserved it? Well, what does deserve mean? Yes, he deserved it in the sense that when the Montgomery bus boycott began after Rosa Parks was arrested for sitting on the front of a city bus in Montgomery, Dr. King had the right ingredients, the right elements, the right talents for that right period in history. He was an eloquent Southern Baptist minister, Southern accent, a great preacher, a great orator, and one who had the unique ability to appeal to the consciences of American people. He could use rhetoric, and he did use rhetoric, which plucked the heartstrings of people because it dealt with things which most Americans believed that they believed. The Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. The Hebraic Christian tradition, quoting scripture. And so people immediately were drawn in. So he was perfect for that time. In that sense, Dr. King deserved it. He was not a perfect man. He had his frailties like everyone else. You know, I tell a story in my autobiography, Lay Bare the Heart, now when he invited the Freedom Riders to have dinner with him when we reached Atlanta. He didn't even pick up the tab. You know, he invited all 14 of us.
And took you to a very expensive restaurant.
Took us to an expensive restaurant. I waited and waited after we had finished eating, had coffee, more coffee and more coffee, and I was sure he was going to pick it up. Nothing happened. So I said, well, if I start trying to pick it up but move very slowly, then he'll beat me to the punch. But I moved slowly, and I got the bill, and I had to pay it. Well, so he was frail, as all of us are, and he had his weaknesses. But his contribution was enormous. Yes, he deserved it.
You write that Malcolm X really didn't get along at all with most of the civil rights leaders of that time. And you engaged in a series of debates with him on I guess the lecture circuit, mm-hmm. and probably at universities as well. And at some point, he said that you should call off the debates, that you shouldn't debate anymore.
Yes, and I think he was right. I was walking along 125th Street in the heart of Harlem one day, and passed by, met Malcolm X, and he says, "Brother James, let's stop in here and have a cup of coffee." We went into the Shabazz restaurant, one of the Muslims' restaurants. And as we drank coffee, he says, "Brother James, I suggest that we stop debating each other because I know what you're going to say and you know what I'm going to say, that I could make your speech for you, you could make my speech for me. I'm not going to convince you, you're not going to convince me." Says, "I think we are just conducting a circus of two black guys belting each other's brains out for the amusement of largely white audiences. Said, I suggest that we don't debate, that if I have anything to say to you, I call you up and come by your house and say it, and if you have anything to say to me, that you do the same." I agreed with him, and that's the way we played it. We became good friends, though we disagreed on many things.
Didn't you end up being you say you were the only civil rights leader at his funeral.
Yes.
Were you disappointed that other people weren't there, other leaders weren't
there? No, I wasn't disappointed. I hadn't expected them to be there. But I had to go because he was a friend of mine, and you go to funerals of your friends. You go to say a final goodbye to them. I regretted his death very much and felt a terrible sense of loss at it, and I do not think his murder has been completely solved.
I think two innocent men are still serving time for his murder.
Do you have any insights into who the murders might be?
Well, not who, but what.
What?
Yes, I think his assassination was tied in with the drug traffic in Harlem, which is tied in to organized crime or the mob, the syndicate, which has its international ties. Malcolm was hurting their business. He was telling people in his street corner meetings on Saturday afternoons in Harlem, at Harlem Square, where thousands of Harlemites came. He was saying, "You know who the pushers are? Get them out of Harlem. Chase them out. As you know them by sight. You know what they look like. You know the clothes they wear, the cars they drive, the women on their arms. Said, chase them out of Harlem. They're killing, they're destroying your people." It was beginning to work. Pushers were being chased out of Harlem, physically chased out. Well, the mob would not put up with that. There's considerable evidence that they were tied into the killing. Now, one of the men who was convicted of his murder confessed late in the trial that, yes, he said, "Yes, I killed Malcolm." He said, "I was paid to kill him." He refused to say who paid him, how much he was paid, or why he was paid to kill him. He said he was not a Muslim, but refused to say what his religion was. He said, "These other two men, these two Muslims on trial with me, had nothing whatever to do with it." He said that he had three accomplices, and these two Muslims were not among them. He never saw them before the trial began, yet all three of them, including the two innocent Muslims, were convicted of his murder.
Hmm. My guess is James Farmer. After the Freedom Rides, when you were up north, you probably knew this before, but you had a very kind of... you had quite a realization of the fact that street kids, teenagers in Harlem, for instance, were not going to be very taken with the idea of passive resistance and of the Gandhian principles. And there was a Harlem riot that you knew was going to happen after some police officers killed a black teenager. And you did your best to try to quiet the crowd and send everyone home, and they wouldn't go. How discouraging was it for you to realize that passive resistance wasn't going to work in every community, that not everybody was going to be convinced of it or was going to have the kind of temperament and political belief that could follow that?
Well, that wasn't discouraging to me, because I had not expected that nonviolence would work in a riot situation, where rationality has flown away and emotions have run wild. I did not expect those kids in Harlem to respond to a message of nonviolence at all. Like, they wouldn't even listen to a message of nonviolence. And I knew they wouldn't. No. I think once a riot gets started, then one cannot stop it. It requires police action then, but it requires trained police action. Not like the Harlem police at that time, who panicked when a bottle was thrown from a roof and started shooting their guns like cowboys. Police that are trained for that kind of action so as not to take provocative action, but to calm things down. I don't think an individual leader can, black leader, can stop a riot. Dr. King went to Watts. I refused to go to Watts after the Watts riot in Los Angeles began. I refused to go because of the Harlem experience. But Dr. King went there and tried to stop it and couldn't. He spoke at a big meeting at a church and began preaching his sermon. The crowd was listening sullenly. He said, "And I think what all the Negroes in Watts ought to do is get together and..." And the audience completed his sentence. "Burn, baby, burn," they said. That was the slogan of Watts, remember. And he couldn't go on with his sermon. No. The individual black leader cannot stop a riot with soft talk once a riot gets started. The way to stop a riot is before it starts.
Do you think in a way that those riots really served an important function? Because after all, a lot of people who thought that civil rights was a problem in the South and not something Northerners had to really worry about in their own neighborhoods got really scared after the riots and thought that maybe there were some changes that needed to get made. because these people really meant business. They were going to get really violent. Mm-hmm.
Well, I am not one of those absolutists on nonviolence who claims that violence never accomplishes anything good. That flies in the face of history. Violence has often accomplished something worthwhile, and there are things which nonviolence cannot accomplish. So I do believe. Now, your question again. I forgot your question. I was thinking of the answer.
Well, do you think in a way it's in some way that it's good the riots happened? Because they stirred off things that quelling the riots wouldn't have accomplished.
I think it is tragic that in our country sometimes you have to have a crisis before people think. And that is what happened. For example, after Watts in Los Angeles, the Watts riot, I went out there after the riot was over and talked to some of the youngsters who had been rioting. I said, now, look, guys, what do you think you accomplished? Look at your community. You burned it down. You tore up your own community. What do you think was accomplished by it? You know what one of those kids said to me? A kid about 18, 19. He said, Mr. Farmer, you know what we got here? What we got here is instant renewal. He said, the city's going to pour money in, the state's going to pour money in, the federal government's going to pour money in. Everybody wants to pour millions of dollars in here to set up, to build swimming pools, recreational facilities, and everything else, so we won't do it again. That's too bad that it had to come to that kind of cataclysm before people realized that there was a Watts and that there were problems that desperately cried for solution.
After your years of doing the Freedom Rides and being out on the street speaking to people and being on the lecture circuit and being a very visible civil rights leader, you decided to take a position with the Nixon administration when they offered you a position in HEW. You left a year later. Is that something you'd recommend to any activist, any political activist, that they take a position in an administration that they oppose, thinking that their being there will do more good than their absence would?
Well, it's not something I'd recommend to anybody. I would only recommend it to those who have thick skins, because they're going to take a lot of barbs. They'll take a lot of heat. Now, before I took the job as Assistant Secretary for Administration at HEW, in 1969, I talked with civil rights leaders. I talked with Roy Wilkins. I talked with Whitney Young, asked for their views, and they agreed that I should do it. I talked even with black students, militant students, told them I had this offer. What do you think? I asked. They said, you got to take it. We can't boycott any administration for 4 years in Washington, and we got to have somebody inside that we can trust who can find out where the bodies are buried and who will know where the pots of money are that community organizations can apply for. So you got to do it. But even when I got there, then I began being barraged with letters. What are you doing there? Come on out. Get out of here. But I expected that, and I understood it.
But you couldn't. You felt you couldn't be effective in that position.
Well, I was effective for a while, but the frustration soon outweighed the effectiveness. It came to a point when I couldn't face myself very well in the mirror. That came when I was called by the press repeatedly and asked what I thought about Nixon's nomination to the Supreme Court of Judge Carswell from Florida. Now, I knew of Judge Carswell's reputation. I remembered what Core lawyers had said about him when I was head of Core. That said that he was hostile to everything that we were interested in. Now, he had been nominated to the Supreme Court. Now, when I was called by the press and asked what I thought, I had to consider the things I had going in HEW. Head Start, the Office of Child Development, which reported to me, the Office of New Careers, training and, you know, retraining and upward mobility in-house and out-of-house. I had to consider the management intern program, which I had integrated, where it had been Lily White all along. These things would go by the board if I left then. If I was going to attack the administration at that point on the Carswell nomination, I'd have to resign or be fired. And I decided this was not the occasion or the time for me to do that. So what I said was no comment, and that hurt my soul.
So you had to resign after that?
Yes. After that, I couldn't shave in the morning very easily.
Do you think that period in Mississippi where so many freedom riders were imprisoned for 40 days and 40 nights, and then there were new shifts of new prisoners to take the place of those who were bailed out, was a turning point in the freedom rides?
I think it was a turning point in the freedom ride and the movement. What I sought to do, in addition to solving the problem of segregation, ending the problem of segregation in interstate travel, was to add a new dimension to the movement at that time. Prior to that, people had been getting arrested but had been bailing right out. Now we were going to take it one step further into Gandhiism by remaining in jail. And so we stayed in 40 days and 40 nights rather than bailing ourselves out. Some few elected to stay in their whole term of a year and one day. Another thing, in the past, opponents of the movement of the South had charged that the movement is led by outside agitators and had spread the view that unless you live in this community, you have no right to be involved in activities here. Well, we wanted to deny that and fly in the face of it and express the view that if you live any place in this country, as a citizen of this country, you have not only a right, you have a duty to be concerned about evil wherever it exists in the country, and then to become actively involved in trying to correct it. So that's what we did in the Freedom Ride. So we put the movement on wheels, as it were.
You had mentioned that the Kennedys tried to get you to call off the Freedom Rides, and you didn't. What do you think of John F. Kennedy's role in the civil rights movement? Looking back, I mean, do you hold him in a lot of esteem for his efforts there, or do you think that he was manipulative then?
Oh, I hold him in esteem, but he had to be educated. He had to be dragged along. At first, when he occupied the White House, he knew very little about civil rights, knew very little about blacks. In fact, he told Jackie Robinson during the campaign of the night of 1960, when he was running for president, he said, "Mr. Robinson, can you introduce me to some Negroes? I don't know any." Well, he hadn't come in contact with any blacks. He'd lived in a separate world from blacks throughout his life. But his instincts were good, if I may use that term loosely, so that he learned quickly and he responded. And he responded better and better. I think his brother, Bobby Kennedy, who at first was reacting and responding to our actions in the civil rights movement on the basis of political expediency, actually came to believe passionately in what he had been doing. He developed that passionate feeling for civil rights and for anti-war sentiments after his brother's assassination, when he did some soul-searching and reaching and thinking. Then he really cared.
This is probably an unfair question to ask, but let me try. If you were getting your start now in the civil rights movement, if you were in your late teens or early 20s and looking ahead to your future and to the future of the country, what kind of work do you think you'd try to do and what kind of tactics do you think you'd use?
What kind of work and what kind of tactics? Well, first of all, the philosophy that I use. I'm going to have to try to heal the nation. One of the bad side effects of Jesse Jackson's race for the presidency, and there were many positive things that came out of it, more blacks were registered to vote and politicized and so forth, but it did further polarize the electorate in the American community. The Republicans, the Reaganites, were able to out-register us. They registered many more poor whites in the South than we registered blacks, and they outvoted us, and they used Jesse to scare whites into registering, and so on. Well, I would have to understand that I have to serve as a bridge, that I have to try to bring black and white together, and that if we're going to make our way in politics, we're going to have to be able to appeal to the white vote as well as the black vote. I look at the good mayor of Philadelphia, who has been able to get white votes in order to get elected. He had to assume that he had the black support, which he did, and then to go after the white support. When Kennedy was running for president, suppose he had campaigned only among Catholics or had used Catholic rhetoric. Where would he have gotten? No place at all. Well, I think if I were young, that's what I would do now. I would begin trying to bring them together. Knowing that I had a solid black base, I would go after the white sport.
We only have about a minute left, but it's interesting to me that after you initiated so many unconventional actions that had nothing to do with the test cases in the Supreme Court or elections or anything, you were out in the streets on the freedom rides, that now if you were young, you'd be focusing on the voting booth. And I'm sorry, I've only left about a minute for you to respond to that.
On the voting booth?
Yeah, you know, that's what you'd see as being the priority.
Well, that's one of the things, but it's not the only thing.
Uh-huh.
I'd be concentrating on many other things. One of the things is a rebuilding of the people. I would be working with the home, with the family, and I would try to save these young people before they are lost, the young people who are out on the streets now, illiterate, without skills, and on drugs.
I want to thank you very much for sharing so much of your life with us today. It's really been very special to have you here. Thank you very much
for
doing the interview.
I've enjoyed it.
And my guest has been James Farmer, who has written a memoir about his life titled Lay Bare the Heart. He's a civil rights activist, co-founder of CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality, led the freedom rides through the South, which desegregated bus terminals. And if you'd like to read his book, it's called Lay Bare the Heart, an autobiography of the civil rights movement. It's published by Arbor House. And if you'd like to meet him, he will be at a book signing and reading this evening at Robin's Bookstore. And that's at 108 South 13th Street. That's 108 South 13th Street at 7 o'clock this evening. And for more information, you can call 735-9600. Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you.
It's minute and a half to 5 o'clock. All Things Considered is coming up from National Public Radio at 5. Tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air after we check in with shadow traffic.
Eastbound Expressway motorists will find it slow from Route 202 through the crossover. 7-minute delay there. If you're heading into town, it's slow from Spring Garden Street to South. 15-minute delay for motorists heading through that area. Westbound Expressway is slow from the University Avenue off-ramp through South Street. Speed 0 to 10 miles per hour. Expect a 15-minute delay. Ray Street slow from 6th Street to the I-95 on-ramp. And northbound I-95 is slow for a mile and a quarter approaching Race due to an earlier brush fire. That's shadow traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is Ray Coob.
A shadow traffic report was funded by SEPTA. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by pediatrician Richard Ferber, author of a new book on child sleep disorders. At 3:40, Bob Carlin hosts The Record Ranch. We'll also have part two of a program on back disorders. And at about 4:15, we'll hear from composer and musician Terry Riley, who will be performing in concert on Friday. I think it's Friday, here in Philadelphia. So that about does it for this afternoon's program. Jay Goldman was the technical director, production assistance from Greg Allen, Maeve McGoran, associate producer, Danny Miller, co-producer of the show. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Susan Stamberg.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
Look at the amount of money that's lost, not only to writers, but to below-the-line people that work on these shows.